CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com, Tuesday morning, the 2nd of June, and you are here with us live. Sure, there's a lot to cover, but one of the stories that grabbed my attention yesterday, which we haven't yet spoken about, and it just shows you how industrious some thieves can be. Did you see that story about the South African thieves who tunneled into a Joburg liquor store? Did you see that story?
In that Johannesburg.
I saw it and I couldn't understand what was happening with that floor.
I had to go and view the pictures myself as well.
So this was in Newtown in Johannesburg. It was robbed by thieves. They tunneled through solid concrete to gain access to the liquor store. The incident, but, I mean, you only hear this for banks, you know, where...
Where did they get the floor plans? How did they know?
I think, you know, usually you can get, even inside shopping malls, if you just look at the map, the layout of a shopping mall, you can usually see where different places are positioned. So if you have a good guess, you can normally come up somewhere in the shop.
I mean, and hopefully not under a shelf.
Well, I suppose if you found a shelf, you just keep tunneling a little bit further. It's not, you know, it's not the end of the world if you have to go an extra meter this way or that way. But I mean, you could have the shelf collapse on you. You could have. There's a lot. I mean, this is very dangerous, but you've got to admire these guys and their ingenuity. And imagine the desperation that forces you to think about tunneling into a place. Usually, this is reserved for bank robbers.
And this is why you know it's not desperation, Garrett.
Oh, okay.
It's just absolute the industriousness of thieves, as you said. It has nothing to do with desperation.
It's insane.
To go through all of that work, to go to all of that effort,
right,
has nothing to do with desperation. You're not just dying for your, like, shot of Johnny Walker.
Well, do you know how tough concrete is?
If you look at the if you look at the pictures from the shop, you can see they left a lot of liquor on the store on the shelves. Now, if you're going to go to the trouble of tunneling into a liquor store, you must take everything.
Yes,
you must have a team of people helping you to take bottle by bottle every single thing in the shop out. Otherwise, you really are just quite amateurish.
Because Thumbsuck, how long do you think it took them? Look, we don't know whether they were tunneling in from somewhere in the building or from outside or from a neighboring property, but this is not a one-day job.
Well, they did return a few times to steal a large amount of stock, but the ShopRite loss control manager, Oswald Mehring, said the suspects were first recorded on CCTV cameras on 21 May. That's just 10 days before.
10 days ago.
Yeah, it's not even that long ago. Footage from inside the stores shows three suspects, although more could have remained in the tunnel to help move the large quantity of liquor. Mehring said the thieves made off with whiskey, brandy, gin, cider, vodka, and beer with an estimated value of 300,000 rand.
So that is a that's
pricey.
That's not like black market prices. That's not like a bottle of Gordon's at $300.
No.
That's just the normal price of the stock.
But in the picture, I see there's still stock left over, so they really could have done a better job.
I just think, though, would I ever... No, I would never be that... I would never be that desperate, actually.
So, but if they were...
a friend to say, hey, let's
they
go.
Had 10
let's
days.
Go.
They were seen on the CCTV on the 21st of May.
Yeah.
Inside the store, they still needed to tunnel through from wherever they were tunneling from. So this could have been a month-long endeavor.
Now, when you think about it that way, it's quite impressive.
And 300,000 rands were a 300,000 rand payday.
Yeah.
For a month's worth of labor is not bad.
As you say, it's quite a lot of hard work. We should be impressed.
I think these people are going to be notorious in prison as well.
Yeah, you think they'll have quite a good reputation among other prisoners?
Well, no.
Have they been caught?
I don't know.
If they are caught and they go to prison, I think they'll be notorious because you can't just put people like that in cells because you know Well, they have
tunnel out.
Free time, idle hands. Yes. Right. They'll tunnel their way out of there. But then I have so many questions. Like, what were they using? Because you don't want to use something loud that will garner people's attention. But at the same time, I don't see them just trying to get their way through with, a shank or something.
Listen, there's a big story that really is an important one in South Africa today. Businesses are now free to trade with only their self-issued permits. They don't need government licenses relating to state of disaster stuff. And that is because of a court case that was won by Saka Licha, who really we should all be grateful to. So they instituted this urgent application. No enforcement agency, that includes police, army, or anyone else, may require a SIPSA certificate or any other license that was not required before the state of disaster in order to do business. So if you issue your own business certificate, you're allowed to continue to operate at this point, which is really interesting. Several types of businesses, as announced in the Level 3 regulations, remain prohibited. All other businesses are free to operate without first obtaining some new government license. So don't let anyone tell you otherwise. That was a very big deal. Saka Licha, a victory in court was yesterday. Minister Ibrahim Patel and the CIPC's preemptory withdrawal of their system on Sunday. In the judgment, the unwithdrawn regulations by the Minister of Small Business Development were set aside, and the unlawful status of any would-be CIPC certificate enforcement was confirmed. Judgment was awarded with costs. So the courts, again, standing up for ordinary South Africans who want to earn a living. Good move. Middle finger to government. This is very, very good.
I think it is good for a lot of people who value their freedom and they just want to get on with doing things. But I think it's also going to open the door for people who want to just do as they please. I think the government is losing control here because, the way they've hyped up something like flying again, you're only allowed to fly for business purposes. Who knows what I just create on my Microsoft Word to say, yes, I actually have to go to Cape Town for official business. Meanwhile, no, I just want to go there to see my family.
So what? Why shouldn't you? Again, these rules are stupid, and now they've painted themselves into a corner. So I don't see why any of us should have to take any of it seriously. It's ridiculous.
In my mind, the way I now see the president's stance is much like particularly my dad's parenting style, and I'm not really trying to
explain,
paint him in a bad light. But my dad, I think by the time I rolled around four kids deep, he was just tired. He was like, okay, whatever.
Do what you want. Yeah.
I've told you and I've tried to advise you, go ahead and do it.
That's exactly right.
It's in your head.
Yeah. That's what the government keeps on saying. I'm tired. Go do it.
Yeah, they were so full of rules and regulations and laws in the beginning, and we were all like trying to comply.
First child parenting.
Yeah. And now it's down to fourth child.
Except for the fact that, so the thing about it in communications, we know this, right? It's always about your customer and the person that you're talking to. Mm-hmm. What the government failed to recognize is that South Africans, by and large, are not the kind of people that follow rules. And the stricter the rules, the more we just want to break them for the simple breaking of rules. We're not those people. We just don't follow rules like that. We're not compliant.
You could say
that's
that
what happened here.
Well, I want to turn our attention to something else that's I think a lot more positive than some of the news that we've seen in the last little while. How would you like to get together for Cape Town during these tough times? Why I'm bringing up those particular words is because that's the hashtag, Together for Cape Town, that Capetonian Philip Hartman first saw and created. And the current lockdown has devastated the country in so many ways. The economy will send many people into unemployment and some of them starvation, which is a very unfortunate situation. But Philip then set a target of raising enough money for 3 million meals for underprivileged children before the year is out. Now, that's quite a task, but we'll find out more because Philip joins us on the line. Philip, thank you for making some time for us this morning. How's Cape Town looking, first of all?
Hey, how's it, guys? Thanks for having me.
Sure.
It's looking cold and dark.
Now, Philip, you've done an incredible thing here. I mean, firstly, you're from Germany, right? That was where you were born, and you moved to South Africa. Is that correct?
Sorry, the line went bad. Okay. What did you say?
So you were actually you're from Germany, right?
I'm from Germany, yeah.
And you've made your home in South Africa, and then you took a look around you and decided, hang on, there's something I can do here. 3 million meals for underprivileged kids before the end of this year is a big task. Are you feeling confident that you can make that happen?
Yeah. You know, I mean, you've talked about it in length. We don't have to go into that. You know, the lockdown has basically brought an unbelievable amount of unemployment, and I think it's only going to get worse. We talk about it a lot in entrepreneurs organization, and you know, many, many businesses are struggling. And so I think giving the fish isn't obviously the first solution or the best solution always, but at this moment, it's just what's required immediately. And so what we're setting out to do with togetherforcapetown.com is really, a system, or let's say an umbrella in terms of communication, where other companies, organizations and individuals can fit underneath that umbrella, and participate in many ways. So what we did was we started with adding an NPO or NGO in Switzerland and in Germany, so that we were able to issue tax certificates for those donations.
Right.
And then we started raising money in Germany and Switzerland first, because, I mean, to raise money here kind of defeats the purpose, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So how it works is that companies can link into our platform. For instance, there's a company called Pasteo. They, funny enough, sell fasting courses in Switzerland and fasting supplements, food supplements.
Mm-hmm.
And for every product they sell, they are feeding one child 3 times a day.
Sure.
Or there's a South African company called, A Virtual. They have virtual assistants here in Cape Town. I think 200 or so. And they literally sent an email out to their customers who are based in England and the States and that. And they just asked, do you want to add 10 euros or 10 pounds to your bill next month? Yeah, of course they do. They're corporate companies, you know, they don't care. So what we're creating that way is it becomes a perpetual kind of cash flow. And I don't have to call 10 million people all the time, but we're just scaling via the platform. And of course, thank you for giving us reach here via things like this.
No, sure. It sounds like such a good cause. And, you know, when people are desperate, then something like food can be a matter of life and death. This is not a question of, you know, kind of helping people who need to get some cash flow in their business or anything like that. These are kids who, through no fault of their own, have found themselves in a very ugly situation. And if we can feed this many children in togetherforcapetown.com, that's a terrific idea. So just tell me quickly about your own story, because you've been here 18 years and you're an entrepreneur and you run your own business here.
Yeah.
And you're also, you just became a dad of twins and triplets within 13 months. I mean,
that is insane.
Twins and then triplets.
Yeah. 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 So let me tell you, I love this. My favorite topic, of course. Do you have kids?
No, God, no.
Yes, no. I do.
You do, then you understand.
I can't imagine 5 under the age of 3.
Yeah, we are now 6 in lockdown because we took the nanny in, because I knew what was going to happen. You know, my brother lives in China, but different topic. So how this, all these kids came about was, you know, we always wanted children, and my wife's also from Munich, and I came here in 2002. She came in 2009. And we tried forever and ever, and it didn't work. And then we had a pregnancy that didn't work, and it was quite stressful. And then we adopted 2 beautiful twins here in Cape Town.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were like, yeah, let's try again. It's going to take 10 million years for the next one. And, of course, within like last time, and, of course, within 6 months, she fell pregnant with triplets. And so
we...
Like natural triplets. This with fertilization or is just natural triplets?
Yeah, I always say doggy style takes a litter. but I mean, you know, what I realized, and this is really close to my heart, I want to share this if I may, my podcast story. I realized that, you know, throughout this whole journey, it was quite stressful, really, you know, because the triplets obviously came early. They came 10 and a half weeks early, and that was stressful. They were in NICU. Sure. The twins came, like I had the twins. They were only 6 months when Vanessa basically fell pregnant. And, you know, when they were, we got them at 6 months. We had them at 1.5. So they were 1 year when she had to be hospitalized. So what I realized was there's nothing out there for dads. And so I started this project called Dedicated.com, like dedication, but with an A.
Mm-hmm.
And I speak to interesting dads around the world with an effort to empower other dads. And it's really, really interesting. I actually spoke to quite some South African figures, interesting figures, like Conrad Stolz. He's a triathlon champion and Olympian athlete. Mm-hmm. And what I realized here is, and maybe this suits also with COVID and the lockdown, there's a great lack of support for fathers in this country.
Yeah.
You do have... There's a global epidemic of fatherlessness.
Mm-hmm.
But I think especially in this place and in this context, it's very important that we support family. And there's enough stuff for moms, so I just do something for dads. You know, sort of competition.
I think that's terrific. And it's great to hear that there is someone thinking about dads as well, because as you mentioned already, in this country, we do have something of an epidemic in fatherlessness. But there's a guy that I want to introduce you to, a guy called Craig Wilkinson, if you haven't already met him. Because he's our go-to guy when it comes to talking about the role of fathers in society and, you know, role modeling and all the rest of it. And he's got some really interesting insights. So maybe you should get him on your podcast at some point.
Yeah.
He's really
cool. I would love to speak to him. Yeah.
Let's just talk about Together for Cape Town again. So how does it actually work? You managed to raise money, primarily in Switzerland and Germany, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are people donating in South Africa, but literally we've only been going for 3 weeks and the uptake's been phenomenal. You know, we've been able to pay 55,000 meals already. Hmm. And we haven't spent all the money. I think we've raised, last time I checked, was like 35,000 euros. You know, it's because it's a system, right? So predominantly it was Switzerland and Germany. I'm busy onboarding, hopefully, a Dutch organization this week. So we'll broaden our reach there. And then I'm speaking to a friend of mine who's from Sweden who also lives in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully we can onboard someone from Sweden. I mean, the communication umbrella is so powerful because everybody can relate to Cape Town as a beautiful place, right?
Yeah.
We're not saying we are the Feed 3 Million Kids Who Are Hungry and Sitting in the Dirt organization, because people... unfortunately, from a communication perspective, can't deal with that, cope with that anymore. They almost have giving fatigue, if you know what I mean. So we want to say Cape Town is beautiful. It's a beautiful place. And we are now trying to help us to make sure Cape Town stays as beautiful as it is. And the first thing we need to do is feed children. Yeah. And we're doing this by the end of the year. We want to reach 3 million. And then obviously we will pivot back to education and youth empowerment.
Hmm.
You know, another thing we did, we managed to get media from a TV channel in Germany. So literally that spot is being aired that you see on the website togetherforcapetown.com
mm-hmm.
Until end of August, you know, so that helps a lot. And you can just donate via SMS. You don't even have to get off the couch. You know, you can't even buy a beer at Oktoberfest for 10 euros. So really, you know, 3 million meals is not even a house in Munich.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
Come on.
Sure, it's amazing. It's a wonderful initiative.
Thank you.
Yeah, well done there, Philip. And I'm glad that we could we found out about you and we could give you just a little bit of thanks from the people who are stuck all over this country who feel so often that they do either have giving fatigue or that the problems are insurmountable or, you know, that there's not enough that we can do. And it's good to see that there are people who just roll their sleeves up and get stuck in. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Very, very good. Yeah. You can go to togetherforcapetown.com and you can help Philip to support this very, very worthy initiative. And Philip, good luck. And good luck with all those children, man.
Yeah, thank you.
To buy a bus.
I was just picturing twins and getting the news of triplets. Yeah. I think I'd have 2.7 seconds of excitement and then amazing. The rest of time of panic going,
Yeah, but look, it's super, super rewarding. And actually, you know what? Family, I think families, are getting this amazing gift. Okay, besides people are going hungry and companies are going bankrupt and all of that, you know, that those are different topics. But I think people, fathers especially, if they're working, and mothers, are getting this amazing gift of being able to spend time with the family, or having been the last, what, lockdown's been since 27th of March.
10 weeks.
Kind of being forced to spend time with the family. And that's really, really valuable. Like, you know, suddenly people realize you don't have to be in the office all the time. You don't have to be stuck in traffic. You know, if you do home office, you literally have 3 additional hours a day where you're not stuck in traffic twice with the family. And that is really, really valuable. And that is also required in this country. And by the way, it makes no sense to stick everybody in a car, make sure everybody gets stuck in traffic, and then make sure everybody arrives at work at the same time. Like, this is from 1900, where you had to do this with the machine, pull a lever, and everybody stands in one line. Right. You have the internet.
Absolutely. No, no, you're 100% right. And I think it is going to permanently and positively change some people's lives, despite the fact that there are obviously hardships that come along with that and some difficulties, which we will have to deal with one by one. Like, you're dealing with the difficulty of starvation and hunger in Cape Town for kids. But thank you, Philip. Nice to talk to you.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Philip Hartman. Isn't that cool? See, Pumps, there's some good people doing some really good stuff. And I'm just pleased that we managed to find out about Philip and connect with him this morning.
What's the hashtag again?
Togetherforcapetown.com.
And anybody can give. So
yeah, you go to the website, hashtag Together for Cape Town, but the website's togetherforcapetown.com. Yeah, you can give. Or I suppose they you know, that like a lot of organizations, they probably need some people to volunteer too, maybe to hand stuff out. So who knows? There could be something you could do in this winter while we are complaining about the cold, but we're all actually indoors. You know what I mean? It seems a bit silly when you think of it that way.
Yeah, what's really cool about it is you don't have to start it. Somebody's already started. You just have to plug in.
Hmm. Yeah.
And look, I do get that giving fatigue is a real thing. But man, when you look at what's going on and the number of people who need any sort of help, I think, you know, if you're able to give, I think you should.
Well,
especially Sia, when you can't Google the price.
Listen,
that's your embarrassment for the morning, Sia.
Not at all. I'm wearing this badge with pride.
Let me tell you, there are people who are. Sia is a disgrace. Sis, from Neil.
I say this also to proudly stand firm in the fact that I'm confident in the gifts that I give. So you can gladly Google away as
How
well.
How did this even begin, Sia? At which point in your life did you turn to this atrocious behavior?
I've never been a person who likes, who spends a lot on myself. I don't know, I've just always find that a little odd. I don't like having expensive stuff. It's just never been me. So it started by knowing the price just to re-gift. I think, and I still maintain, that's a good enough intention. And so when I want to find out the price for something, then I re-gift, and I think someone else will appreciate it more than me. So since then, it's always been a habit of mine. In all of my 25 years, really, the fact that my sister called me out was the first time I even gave it enough thought to think, this might be wrong. Other than that, I don't think it is.
Yeah, Sia, you are just wrong. Everybody agrees. Everyone. Fatiswa says that she really enjoyed that interview. What is the guy's surname? Ooh. It's Philip Hartmann. So it's German, Hartmann. Fatiswa. All right. Messages for some other people. Has anyone explored the tunnel from the bottle store side to see where it comes out? Good question. They didn't take me to the other side, to see where it actually, but it must be just on the outside of the store, obviously, in some place where people wouldn't normally look. Well, you can cover that up with boxes and things if you're the thieves, and it's very clever. I think the owners sold all their stock illegally during lockdown and then staged the robbery to account for the loss.
Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
Just sitting there at the end of the tunnel. Shawshank style.
All right, very good. Listen, guys, we've got to get to blind history for today, which is exciting. Today is about Joseph Stalin. We know about him.
It's an extra long episode.
It is a long episode. He is one of the big three of the truly evil people of the 20th century, along with Mao and Hitler. Their combined body count is well over 100 million souls, and most of those weren't even soldiers. Stalin did, however, raise Russia to power, to might, and to glory, and his personal story is human and full of flaws. You can join us in this penultimate episode of The Blind History, Season 3, and you'll discover even monsters can start off like just like you and me. So that's coming up next. Stalin in our penultimate episode of this season of Blind History. All right, Pumi, Sia Mbulelo, we will see you on Tuesday next week again, Pums. And the rest of us will be back tomorrow morning, bright and early, at 6 o'clock. Have a good 2nd of June.
Enjoy your day at the office.
Yes, I'm a little bit apprehensive, like I said earlier. It's the first time I'm going to spend a whole day at the office. So I'll let you know how it goes. Sia's excited to dress up again.
Let me go and put shoes on. Let me put cologne on.
It's the little things, Sia. All right, everybody. Yes. Cool. We will see you tomorrow. Here's Blind History. All about Stalin today. In this Song for Stalin by Rilsky, the lyrics go, "We will all rush to the top with the sunshine in our eyes. By the eagle's solar flight, the leader gives us the true sight. The top is reached by climbing up a mountain of millions of bodies. The sunshine is the promise of nuclear war, and the flight, a dangerous social engineering experiment which spread poverty and misery all over the world. The leader was Joseph Stalin, the man of steel, Russia's totalitarian dictator." Yosef Vissarionovich Stalin, who was born Yoseb Besarionis Ze Djugashvili. Now, those are not the names that we know him by. We call him Joseph Stalin. He was born in 1878, and he was a Georgian revolutionary who led the Soviets into the original revolution in Russia, along with Lenin and Trotsky, and eventually emerged as General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and Premier, eventually really consolidating power to become the country's de facto dictator in the 1930s. A communist, ideologically committed to the Leninist interpretation of Marxism, Stalin formalized these ideas as Marxism-Leninism, while his own policies were known as Stalinism. And for people who are on the left of politics, these definitions really matter. To us, it's a matter of, you know, small differences. So today we focus on one of the bad guys of history, and he has got, quite a margin, a worse reputation than he has a good one. There are parts of modern Russia where they still look at Stalin as a great leader and someone who we could all aspire to be more like. But in most of the world, we regard him as something of a genocidal, dictatorial lunatic. Do you agree with that, Anthony Medra, my co-host for the series and also the MD of Taylor Blinds and Shutters? What do you think of Joseph Stalin?
So, Gareth, this is our third run of Blind History, and this guy's the worst. So, the absolute worst.
So you're saying he's worse than Ivan the Terrible? He's worse than Mao? He's worse than Pol Pot? Or is he just the worst that we've done so far?
In general, I think he's probably the worst. If we just look at who we've done, I just thought the Kims were absolutely crazy. And I mean, this old Stalin is, they look like babies to him. I mean, Adolf looks like Mother Teresa to him.
Yeah, I mean, we can do a death count here if you'd like, because we are in a time of corona and maybe people are interested in how many have died. And Stalin is reckoned to have killed well over 12, maybe even 20, some estimates say over 40 million people in the early stages of his ascent to power. And later on, in the collectivized camps, in assassinations, the removal of people who disagreed with him politically, those numbers just inflate to a point where you really don't know whether you're dealing with actual human lives or a balance sheet.
And that doesn't even take into account the Second World War, because his victories were more about sheer numbers than actual military brilliance. And I think in the Second World War, 65% of the Red Army was killed or taken in as prisoners of war, which is a massive amount.
Yeah, it's frightening. You know, it's what they call a Pyrrhic victory, which is something which comes up in history quite a lot. A Pyrrhic victory where you win, for all intents and purposes, you have conquered the enemy or you've beaten them, but it's at huge cost. And you almost look back on those kinds of battles and wars and you think, was it worth it? Russia has never really managed to get back to the population numbers that they had before the communist revolution and World War II. And although there were many people who were impoverished in those times, you could argue that their population decline and the fact that they currently have a population crisis is as a direct result of what's been happening over the last 100 years.
But interestingly enough, Stalin did a census, and it was very important for him to prove to the world and to his people that what he was doing was successful and it was great to live in Russia and it's growing and expanding. And I think he did the census in 1932. And what happened was he estimated a certain population size and the census came back significantly less than what he predicted. So he just took them and shot them all, the census crew. And then a year later, he did a new one. And can you believe it? But that was exactly what he predicted.
Yeah, surprise. Yeah. Let's start off, because this guy has a very interesting story, and by no means is he to be ignored. You know, I think his great biographer wrote that he was probably the single most influential person of the 20th century. And I don't know that that's too much of a grab, because if you look at how much was achieved by Russia during Stalin's time and how much he as a single person affected and influenced the history of the world, I think it's fair to say that he's certainly in the top three, and his biographers say he's number one. So let's start at the beginning, because his origins are quite interesting too. He was born in Georgia, not in Russia, and he was considered more Asiatic than Russian. Of course, he later on became known and identified as a Russian man, but he always had a slight Georgian accent, and his beginnings were very much in religion.
So he grew up in a very rough town, Gori, which wasn't too far from Tiflis, which was the capital of Georgia, which was part of Russia at the time. And his mom was a charismatic lady. And it just so happened that Biso, who was Stalin's dad, he was sort of quite defined in Gori for a small period of time. They got married and he ended up being a drunk that beat Stalin and was actually incredible that he actually survived. It was a horrible upbringing with Biso the drunk. But his mom was a very strong character, and she actually liked men's company, and men found her very attractive to such an extent that Stalin sometimes mentioned that Biso wasn't his dad, but this somebody else was his dad. And his mother also disciplined him. She used to beat him, but it was more from a looking after you, trying to make you a good boy and successful side of it. But Gareth, he was very, very intelligent. And I think a lot of people didn't say that, especially after Stalin died during the de-Stalinization process. He was a remarkable student and very successful. He sang beautifully. He wrote beautiful poetry.
Yeah, that's right. He was, you know, although he got into some fights when he was much younger, he also excelled, as you say, academically. He displayed talent in painting, drama. He wrote his own poetry. As you mentioned, too, he sang as a choir boy.
But talking about that, there was such an enigma because Gori, as I said, was such a rough and tough town, and they used to have organized brawls. And, you know, he won a lot of brawls. He won as much as he lost. He was a small guy, but he was very, very tough, and he was a natural leader in those very, very early days.
Yeah, he also had some health problems. I mean, he had smallpox when he was a kid. It left him with facial pox scars, which they had to airbrush out of every party poster later on when he became the dictator. But at 12 years old, he was actually injured. He was hit by a carriage, and it actually caused a lifelong disability to his left arm, which prevented him from active military service.
Yeah, I think it shortened his left arm. It was quite severe, and he was down and out for quite a long time. And that made a big difference. I think the fact that he was only 5'3" and he had his second and third toe, I think, on his left foot were joined. So he had a web foot, which was the sign of the devil at that time. And yeah, there were a few challenges and inferiorities that he took through. And then later on, because he was always on the run and he was caught from time to time and he got rotten teeth from being in Siberia for so long. And so he also had black teeth. So that was another thing that he was quite embarrassed about.
Well, we'll talk about how he ended up in Siberia, but the guy, he didn't have the greatest start in life and he decided to join the monastery. He was going to become a priest and went into the seminary in Tiflis, which you've already mentioned. And he was very good at learning, but he professed himself quite soon as an atheist. He used to stalk out of prayers. He refused to doff his hat to the monks, and they eventually threw him out. He joined a forbidden book club, which was interesting because obviously the revolutionary in him was starting to come to the fore, and started reading about Marxism. And joined a group called the Georgian Socialist Group, the Mesame Dasi. And then he left the seminary and never returned. And that was the beginning of his political career, really. So how did he end up in Siberia?
So at that period that you mentioned, he set up a gang of hitmen, money launderers, racketeering, piracy. I mean, they pirated ships in the Caspian in the Black Sea, bank robber, extortion, and murder. I mean, these things, he could have been John Gotti. It was incredible. And he got physically involved in a lot of these things and stole millions. I think the one bank robbery was $3.4 million. And he took it all to the Bolshevik Party, to Lenin's coffers, you know, to support the revolution, and kept none of it for himself. So he always wore the same clothes and this poor man, but he was such an enigma. I mean, he could have been one of the richest gangsters this world has ever seen.
Yeah, and then he would throw it, as you say, at the party, and his ultimate goal was political power. It wasn't financial wealth. So he obviously got caught, and then they sent him off, as was the custom in Russia at the time, to Siberia, where you were basically in exile. And I mean, he was in the cold. He used to get frostbite. It was a very unpleasant place to be. He was basically up near the Arctic Circle. And didn't he get some 13-year-old girl pregnant?
Correct, yes. He liked the younger ladies. There's no doubt. And in this particular instance, yes, he did get a pregnant 13-year-old. And then true to his form, when Lenin and things happened in 1917 and he managed his escape, he just left her.
He was not known for being a particularly thoughtful husband or boyfriend. And as you say, he eventually managed to escape and he got to St. Petersburg and to Moscow just in time to really join in the revolution, which had got into full swing. But the important events of the revolution, he's been recorded as having been central to them, although a lot of people post his death have tried to make it look like, especially the Trotskyite side of Russian Bolshevism, they tried to make it look like he didn't really play a very integral role.
Gareth, they said he basically missed the revolution, which in large part is true in that he was in Siberia or up at the Arctic. The thing with Trotsky was he was a very arrogant, outgoing, loud person. Whereas Stalin was different. He could work the underground. And they were enemies. So anything that Trotsky said was going to be bad about Stalin. And I suppose the other way around. But ultimately, in the end, he was significantly involved. He was sent to Siberia 4 times. But the whole time he was supporting and bankrolling Lenin. So he had been around for a significant amount of time.
Yeah, I believe that when they eventually managed to form a government, he and Trotsky were the only two people who were allowed into Lenin's study without an appointment. And at that stage, I think Stalin was mostly in charge of food provisions. So he would try to secure the food provisions for the World War I armies. But World War I was kind of a sideshow to what was going on inside Russia, because although they were imperiled and made non-aggression pacts here and there, the real game for Stalin, Lenin, and Trotsky was to get Russia behind them and to really take control. And that meant stamping out opposition. He was also the editor of the Pravda newspaper, which was their chief piece of propaganda. And it's still the most famous piece of communist literature. But Stalin wasn't a fool, and he used to write some pretty interesting articles, most especially around the different kinds of ethnic nationalities within Russia and how all of them, in his opinion, deserved a fair amount of autonomy and self-governance.
But his writings did upset Lenin quite a bit. I think originally he apologized, but he had quite a bit of runnings with Lenin. And I think you're talking definitely about this time where things were really getting heated and about to happen. And Lenin was very concerned about, he needed a fall side to Trotsky's arrogance and snobbery. And so he thought Stalin was the right man. But then a little bit later on, because he appointed him general secretary, which is a position he held till a year before he died. But I think that Lenin started realizing that, sure, this guy, that for the position that he's in, he cannot stay in that position. And he really started considering removing him from that general secretary position. And Stalin started to feel it. But I think the timing was incredible because Lenin started, I think he had three strokes and he already had his first stroke. And Lenin's wife started to speak out against Stalin.
Right.
And then Stalin phoned her and called her a syphilitic whore over the phone.
Yeah.
And Lenin heard about this and then basically said to him, look, if you do not apologize and make things clear, then I think it's the end of the line between you and me. And then the next day, he basically had the worst stroke and died just after that. And I think Stalin spent a bit of time making sure he squashed that discussion.
Yeah, it's famously been recorded that Stalin and Krupskaya, who was Lenin's wife, were not best of friends. And she actually released a whole lot of Lenin's letters, which purport to say that Stalin is not a great guy. He's got bad manners. He's too coarse. He's too rough. He's vulgar. He's rude. And that he shouldn't lead. But a lot of people say that she might have written these letters.
I think in the end, there was no love lost. And unfortunately, if you didn't have a good relationship with Stalin, you were dead. And I think that she ended up like that.
So he took over then after Lenin, but it was by no means an easy job because he had to make alliances with some dodgy people and then break those alliances later on, ultimately with the goal of establishing himself at the center of things. He was not interested in, you know, a communal decision-making body. He wanted to make the calls.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, a dictator is what his ideal was. And I think it was quite easy because Trotsky was looking at the Marxist collective in the whole world, whereas Stalin was saying to his supporters, look, we're looking at it, the Soviet Union. And so he got strong support and Trotsky didn't get the support that he thought he would get. And him and Lenin's wife set up a party and try to go against Stalin. And that was the ultimate demise of Trotsky. He was sent into exile and later on, Stalin sent somebody to go and murder him with an ice pick.
Yeah, another famous death. But I do want to breeze quickly through the years before World War II, because that's where Stalin really came to aggregate immense power around himself. But he went through a number of crises. I mean, the one that's most well known is that famine and the collectivization of farming, where he murdered the kulaks and, you know, the Great Terror, as it's called also, which was the execution of some 700,000 people who we know about. There are many more that we don't know about. There are mass graves all over Russia of people who he called detractors, neoliberals, people who had disagreements with him at a community level and a local level. So the guy was at his most bloodthirsty before World War II. And he really just tore up anyone who was in his way and was merciless at that point. The fact is that a massive famine came about as a result of his destruction of kulak farming. The kulaks were like middle-class bourgeois landowners, and he just confiscated their property and set up the sovkhoz and kolkhoz farms, collective farms. It was a disaster. People were starving all over Russia.
And Gareth, what they did, though, initially the farmers, they decided to burn the equipment, burn their crops, because they refused to hand it over to the state. Anyway, that just played into Stalin's hands, and he did do this collectivization. And what was very, very sad was that he exported a significant amount, and everybody was starving in Russia, and he was still exporting. The amount of people that died was just absolutely frightening because of this famine, and it was this man-made famine that was set up by Stalin.
Yeah, I think, you know, by this stage, most of the bad side of his reputation was unknown to the rest of the world because he had such a stranglehold on information and propaganda. You know, these are the days before mass communication, the internet, telephones, any of that stuff. So it was hard for people who were against Stalin to ever be heard. And that worked obviously in his favor. So World War II comes along. And the first thing that Stalin does is he makes a pact with Nazi Germany, the Ribbentrop Pact. Von Ribbentrop was the German foreign minister under Hitler. And this was maybe counterintuitive, but for Stalin, it was a way of just keeping things in a very delicate balance because he didn't want to fight Germany. He was ideologically opposed to them and to the West, frankly, but he knew at this stage that a non-aggression pact was what he would probably need so that he could build up his defenses.
The war part was very interesting. As you rightly said, he did have a non-aggression pact with Germany, but you know, Adolf Hitler would do whatever he wanted, and his plan was to infiltrate and go into Russia, and the West warned Stalin, informers warned Stalin, his own spies warned him, and that he just basically said, look, you guys are crazy, you don't know what you're talking about. And then there was somebody that deserted Germany and came into Russia and said, listen, on the 22nd of June, Germany's going to invade Russia. And he still didn't believe them. He shot that deserter. And then he realized as Hitler started to mobilize, he said, no, Hitler's going to come at us through Ukraine because it's full of oil-rich lands, and that's the way he's going to come. His general said, no, what was left of his generals, because he'd purged most of the good generals prior to the war. They said, look, he's going to come in through Minsk in the north, and then Moscow is going to be open. So he stuck fast. They sent the Red Army down to the south, and Hitler took Minsk and had a free road basically all the way to Moscow, and a quarter of the Russian Air Force was obliterated by the Luftwaffe. All the airplanes were standing in long lines on the ground because they weren't expecting war.
Yeah.
So it was incredible. There was a massive mistake. And Gareth, this was also quite a big turning point, because after this, he started to defer. If there was one time in his life that he did defer, it was to the generals at the time. But this was just after he said to them, Lenin started our state, but you guys have just fucked it up.
Well, I know that the one military commander he did trust at that point is General Zhukov, who was a war hero. He was probably the most famous Russian general of World War II. And although Stalin had some good ideas, I think he also realized his own shortcomings as a military leader. And increasingly, he did rely on good advice. And slowly but surely, and at great expense in terms of the number of men whose lives were sacrificed and the amount of distance covered and territory, frankly, that was lost, Russia started to beat the Germans back. They also had a scorched earth policy, which had been practiced, 100 and something years before under Napoleon, where basically they just burnt and destroyed everything as they left. Without those supplies and food and warmth, the Germans advancing had nothing to rely on. Their supply chain was getting longer and longer, so it made it impossible for them to win. And eventually, the Russians famously managed to beat back the Germans. And with alliances between them, the French, the Americans, and the British, they started to turn the tide of the war. The Eastern Front had become Russia's to lose, and they started to push into Germany.
Yeah, and I think that British came from the west, the Russians came from the east towards Berlin. Hitler saw the writing on the wall and committed suicide, and the people absolutely raved about it. And Stalin was this massive hero. He'd taken Russia to victory, or the Soviet Union, should I say, and it was a very, very strong time for Stalin in terms of his popularity.
He was obsessed with Hitler, though, and he actually made sure that they found whatever they could of Hitler's remains and brought them back to Moscow. He didn't want them making a shrine out of it in Germany. But I think we eventually got to see what evidence he had collected only about, 10 to 15 years ago when Russia opened up properly. He was obsessed with Hitler, and the two of them were kind of ideological opponents, but I think they had a grudging respect for each other.
But Gareth, you know that the difference between Stalin and Hitler, I suppose, was that Hitler, he had the Aryan race he was trying to build, etc., and he would discriminate heavily against anybody that didn't fit that mold, whereas Stalin didn't discriminate. He didn't care. He killed anybody and everybody. It could be his best friend or his worst enemy. He didn't discriminate.
So let's just talk about Stalin and another great man of history. In fact, two of them. Roosevelt and Churchill, because the three of them were the big three, right? They met at Yalta, they met in Tehran, and famously, they put together what the post-war world would look like. And Churchill didn't get along with Stalin.
Rightly so, I can imagine. I think Stalin was trying to strong-arm. A lot of reports were he felt like he had the upper ground, and he really was prescribing serious acquisition of land and countries. And that's, I think, when a rift started to appear between the West and the USSR.
Yeah, and Stalin made all kinds of demands about, you know, ideological influence over Eastern Europe. And it was shortly after that, in the early 1950s, that Churchill famously made his Iron Curtain comment. But at that point, there were two spheres of influence. There was the sphere of American influence and the sphere of Russian influence, communist influence. And Britain no longer really mattered by that stage. And Stalin had a big idea of influencing not just all of Eastern Europe, but China, North Korea. You know, the Korean War had been entered into fairly shortly after World War II. And Russia was the big daddy of the Eastern Bloc.
Yes. So the Iron Curtain falls, and he was adamant that all the countries will be satellite states of the Soviet Union. And even to that effect, cutting Berlin in half. I mean, that was just frightening. And Gareth, I suppose that was the development of the Soviet Union's version of the atomic bomb, which kickstarted the famous Cold War, which started to begin in earnest then.
Now, it's interesting to know that he died in 1953, but from about 1950, he was in very poor health. And he lived mostly at his dacha, which was, you know, like his country house. It wasn't too far from the Kremlin. That's actually where he died. He was found dead on the floor of his bedroom. He'd suffered from a cerebral hemorrhage. And he lay there for 3 days. He hadn't died yet. They only announced his death like 6 days after that. And there was so much confusion when he died, because this guy was absolutely the most powerful man without any threat to his authority from anywhere. And they didn't know who should take over. And there was this coterie of these bizarre men around him, you know, Zhukov, the general. There was Molotov, who was his deputy. There was his daughter, Svetlana. They made a very funny movie of this just 2 or 3 years ago, which is hilarious. And as much as it's funny, that's probably what actually happened. No one knew who would take over.
Yeah, and even Beira, the head of the secret police, he was there. And the day before, he was kissing Stalin on his hand, and the next day he spat on his hand. So it was just crazy, because he thought then he could take over from where Stalin was. But from his grave, it was absolute chaos until Khrushchev finally took over and started the de-Stalinization process.
Well, Khrushchev may have done a de-Stalinization, but when Brezhnev came in, he started a re-Stalinization. And even today, you know, Putin is loath to criticize Stalin. There are obviously things that are now indisputable about just how much of a terror he was. But they did dig him up, then they moved him, because he was originally in the mausoleum with Lenin. And they eventually just put him next to the wall under a little bust. And his legacy is very much like his actual visage, pockmarked and difficult to interpret entirely. We don't know much about his personality, because he was a political creature, but he loved his friends. He liked having his friends around. He certainly seems to have been affectionate with his daughter. We know about his scruffy appearance and the kind of clothing he used to wear. But apparently he had a very soft voice and read furiously. He had like a library of 20,000 books.
Yeah, he could read 500 pages a day or something crazy like that.
Yeah, and he publicly condemned things like anti-Semitism and didn't necessarily like the idea of discrimination, although he practiced that in various ways, shapes, and forms as a dictator. And ultimately, his legacy has to be seen as one of just immense power accumulation and no respect whatsoever for the individual. It was all about what could collectively be done. He saw people as units within a massive machine and didn't care how many of those units had to be either lost in war, executed for disagreeing with him. And I think overwhelmingly, totalitarianism has had its purest expression in the character of Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, and I think, Gareth, that he needed a forum. I mean, he had brains. He was extremely confident and intelligent. He had proper political talents. If you look at the spies that he put into America, you know, to find out and to build industrialization of USSR, he had faith in and also very much experience in violence. He just knew how to get things done through violence. But he was also charming, sensitive, ruthless. He had a lack of empathy a lot of the times. And he was just weird. But there's so many attributes coming together. And it's just almost like the perfect storm in 1917. This individual could apply all of these attributes into forming this dictator.
Yeah, I mean, maybe in 1,000 years from now, they'll look on him like we look on Alexander the Great or one of those people. But certainly one of the most brutal people to have ever walked the earth. And also a hugely impressive historical figure. So as much as you and I don't necessarily like him, we have to grudgingly give the guy a huge amount of respect for what he managed to do. Horrible as some of it was, to have the balls to do that is just something else. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whenever Stalin, during his most powerful times, used to go out to these massive factories and give speeches, or wherever he gave speeches, he wasn't a great orator, people had to clap. And if you stop clapping, sometimes you could end up being shot or sent to Siberia. And there was this one instance where there was a director of the company, after 11 minutes of clapping, stopped clapping. And so he was sent for 10 years to Siberia. So Stalin, in the end, introduced a little bell where people could stop clapping, and they knew when to stop clapping without getting murdered.
Cliffcentral.com.